Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and organizations, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, and behaviorism about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Paul Ashcroft. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today, I'm here with one of my co-authors, Garrick Jones.
Hi there.
And we're delighted to be joined by Editor-at-Large of Frieze Magazine, one of the most important journals in the art world, and author, podcaster, and Instagrammer, Jennifer Higgy. Welcome to The Curious Advantage podcast, Jennifer.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Jennifer, we're very interested in a number of topics that you're an expert about. Curation in particular, we talk about that in the book. There's a whole chapter on it. We think curation and editing are power skills as we're faced with almost infinite access to data and knowledge online these days. And how do we make sense of that? And how do we synthesize information, edit and curate to construct useful and memorable knowledge and even wisdom, perhaps, from all of the data we're faced with? For example, you do this with incredible skill, if I may say, in your Instagram account. It's an amazing focus on women in history of art. And the thing I love about your Instagram account is you have the best messaging and copy. You get an image, and when you look underneath the image, there's a solid, three, four, sometimes five paragraphs of history and a potted introduction to that female artist. And I find it particularly one of the most exciting Instagram accounts that I look at. It addresses, one of the great failures of history, and certainly in the history of art, which is about the very, perhaps very conscious bias of the privileging of male artists in history. And we talk about unconscious bias and criticality in the book too. But that privileging of male artists in history is now being remedied by movements to re-edit the story, of which you are an important part. You've got a book coming out, and the name of your book is?
So the book is called The Mirror and the Palette, and it's out in March next year. It's published by Wheaton, Phil and Nicholson. And it's looking at about 500 years of women's self-portraits. So starting in 1548 in Holland with Catharina van Hemmersen, who was the first artist of any gender to create a self-portrait seated at an easel, and that it ends with Alice Neal's brilliant self-portrait at the age of 80 from 1980.
Really looking forward to that. I feel I've got an intro to it by being going to your Instagram account regularly. And you also have a great podcast called Bow Down, Women mm-hmm. in Art History, which I encourage all of our listeners to take a peek at and subscribe to. It's brilliant if you're interested in art, and certainly brilliant if you're interested in recontextualizing art, understanding the place of women in art history. Just wonderful.
Thank you.
We're excited to find out all about women in history. What would you say is the story of women in art?
Well, the story of women in art, like all stories, is a very complex one. And I think it's important from the start to differentiate between women in Western art history and women in many indigenous cultures around the world. Because, as I'm sure you know, women's creativity and contribution is often at the core of many indigenous cultures around the world. But it's a different story in Western art history. Basically, women have always made art. But for various complicated reasons, there's been a mass gender exclusion from the writing of the history of art in terms of women. There were women in antiquity that Pliny talked about. There were women in the Middle Ages. Many of them were craftspeople. And then, of course, in the Renaissance, there was a great flowering of women's creativity, even though it was so hard for a woman to be an artist. They were banned from apprenticeships, banned from the academy. They weren't allowed to paint naked models. They weren't allowed, for example, to work on a scaffold, which meant that they couldn't work on the great chapels, especially in Italy. But despite all of these things that were thrown against them, still she persisted. And I think this is a fascinating example of the human spirit overcoming you know, terrible things that have been flung against these poor women, they still managed to rise up and create wonderful pictures and sculptures.
It seems, as you say, that women have been ignored throughout history. Why do you think this is? Why do you think women have been ignored?
Well, we have to qualify that slightly, because actually there's something curious happened in the early 20th century, when women were actually ignored more than they had been in previous centuries in terms of art. Although, of course, they weren't given the kind of attention that male artist or male achievement was given. They were mentioned, like Vasari mentioned quite a few women artists. Vasari, of course, is the great Renaissance art historian, in a sense, the first art historian. And then for the next few hundred years, there were quite a few books written about women's contribution. But come the 20th century, there's a sudden silence that happens. It was Linda Nochlin talked about this, about the fact that in the early 20th century, suddenly it was as if women had never made art, even though there are, you know, there are many, many examples, not only of the artists themselves, but they were inscribed in art history, in some art histories. And this could be something to do, I mean, I think you'd have to be a psychologist to fully understand why, but it could be to do with the fact that, you know, we live in a patriarchal society, we live in a society that has always honored white male achievement. And when people in power become threatened, then they start to either erase those histories or ignore them. So that could have been what happened. As women became more empowered, as the 20th century progressed, men became more threatened. I mean, you look at, you know, some of the great textbooks of art history in the 20th century. You've got Gombrich and you've got Janssen. You know, they were the two standard textbooks. In both of the first publishings of their books titled The History of Art, not one woman was mentioned.
Yeah.
And that, apart from anything else, is just bad scholarship.
Janssen was my enormous art book that we had to study for theory of art when I was at school. And you're absolutely right. You know, where are the women in that text at all? It's astonishing. I went to an all-boys school, so you can only imagine the bias I've had to overcome a little bit. It's one of the reasons we've had quite a number of aha moments when we've been writing The Curious Advantage. And one of our chapters is on criticality, and specifically looking at unconscious bias and conscious bias, you know, epistemic injustice, for example. We have to be aware, if we're going to be curious about anything, we have to be aware of our own biases as well as the bias that might be in the things we discover, and, you know, step back for a moment, try and stay emotionally uninvolved and get to a point where we can make a solid judgment about what we're learning. And also enables us to go to places that are, you know, as you say, threatening or might make us feel uncomfortable, because that's where the real learning takes place, we believe. Are there some great stories that you have, or one or two great women in art, historic, modern or contemporary, who you love?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are so many. And when I was writing my book on women's self-portrait, the last 500 years of women's self-portraits, I talk about 22 different women from around the world. And, you know, I'd always known about gender exclusion, but I'd never realized the extent of it. And then you see what some of these women overcame to become, you know, the artists that they were, you know, lauded and successful. And these are phenomenal women. I mean, to be an artist is hard enough. To be a woman artist, say, in the 17th or 18th centuries is really hard. One of my favorite stories is that of the great Renaissance painter, Sofonisba Anguissola, who was born in Cremona. Most women artists from the past, they had a father who was an artist, which gave them access to a studio. But actually, she had a rather rakish nobleman of a father who realized how gifted his daughters were. And I thought, in the best possible way, wanted to exploit their talents and nurture them, because it meant that he might be able to get some money from their gifts. And so Sofonisba was one of five very gifted girls. And she was so gifted that her father sent off some early sketches that she did to Michelangelo. And it was of a young girl laughing. Michelangelo wrote back, apparently, that he loved the drawing, but he would rather see a picture of a young boy crying.
Yeah.
And so Sofonisba then whipped up a drawing of her younger brother being bitten by a crayfish. And this drawing apparently influenced Caravaggio later on.
Yeah.
And anyway, Michelangelo was apparently so impressed that it's not absolutely sure, but there are lots of letters that support the theory that Sofonisba then went to Rome and actually studied informally with Michelangelo for quite a few years. And then she becomes appointed to the court of Philip II in Spain. And she goes to Spain, and there are wonderful eyewitness reports of her dancing wildly at the marriage of Philip II. And then she becomes this renowned painter in Spain. She's married off by the age of 40 because they felt it was a bit scandalous she wasn't married. But her husband then died in mysterious circumstances that involved Albanian pirates. And then on her way back to Italy, this remarkable woman falls in love with a much younger sea captain. And against the wishes of her family, she marries him, and they have a very happy, happy time together. And she dies around the age of 90 in Palermo. And Van Dyck went and painted her. He did a famous portrait of her when she was about 86 or 87. And he said that he learned more about the craft of painting, because apparently she was a terrible backseat painter. She was telling him what to do the whole time. You know, he said she was the greatest teacher, and she became renowned throughout Europe. And yet, who knows about Sofonisba Anguissola, except something rather wonderful happened earlier this year. And the Prado in Spain, in its 250 years, it's only ever once before done a show of a woman artist, Clara Peters, the great Dutch still life painter. And the Prado earlier this year, and I just got to see it before lockdown, did a brilliant two-person show of Sofonisba Anguissola and the other great Italian Renaissance woman painter, Lavinia Fontana, who was very influenced by Sofonisba.
Yeah.
And it was a brilliant, brilliant show. And just seeing the scope of her work. But the problem was, she signed her paintings when she was very young. But when she was older and when she was in Spain, she didn't sign her paintings. So there's a lot of problems around attribution.
So the idea is to find a Sofonisba hanging around somewhere.
Absolutely, yeah.
What can we learn about curiosity from great women in art, do you think?
Well, I think the great women in art, they exemplify the power of curiosity, because these are women who have absolutely no political agency. They're essentially owned by their fathers or their brothers. You know, they're meant to stay in a very rigid and small world as wives or mothers or nuns, essentially. Yet these women look outside the window. They're rampantly curious about what's happening out there. And against all odds, they go out and they find it. They forge careers. They do precisely what you're not meant to do as a woman at the time. And they do it brilliantly, you know, and you can't do that without curiosity about, from the curiosity about, like, how do you mix paint to, you know, how do you ground the canvas? How do you represent your own face? What angle of it do you do?
In this age of photography, it's like making imagery. We forget that making images in the past was highly technical and a huge, you know, craft, and a making and building construction craft, right? From, as you say, grinding the paint, mixing the oils, all the way to forming the final image.
Absolutely.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
Artists are known for being curious, almost a curious species. What would you say is your definition of curiosity, and what has been the role of curiosity in your life?
Well, I think for me, curiosity is the antithesis of complacency. You know, curiosity is about not accepting traditional narratives. It's about being restless with received truths. It's about being creative with what the world throws at you. And it's also about not just reiterating what you know, but about exploring what you don't know.
And do you have an example of where you've tried that out for yourself in your work?
You know, I went to art school in Australia in the 80s and 90s. You know, even then, this is quite recent history. You know, we weren't taught anything about women in art history. You know, I just accepted that narrative at first that, you know, there were no women painters in the Renaissance. There were no great Baroque women painters. There were no painters in the 19th century. But there really were. And I started to discover that there were. I think it was when I read Griselda Pollock's extraordinary book, Old Mistresses. And, you know, so I went, oh my God, there were women, but I don't know about them. And how do I find out about them? And, you know, apart from a few key texts like, you know, the aforementioned Linda Nochlin, Griselda Pollock, Germaine Greer wrote an extraordinary book, The Obstacle Race, which took her 10 years, and that was about women in art history. It's an amazing book. You know, so I started to think, I wonder if I could find a woman who was born every day of the year, a woman artist from the past who I didn't know about. And that's why I started my Instagram account, which then led to my podcast and really led to my book.
You've been the editor of Frieze, which is one of the most important art magazines about today. And we believe it's absolutely vital, the skill of curation and editing, an important part of being curious, especially in the digital age. What do you think are some of the principles for being a great editor or a great curator?
Obviously, every editor brings their own stamp to a magazine. But for me, it was very important that we had a real balance in Frieze between looking at, say, an established artist who we hadn't covered before with an emerging artist who not many people might know about, but we thought was doing something really interesting, about recognizing what the, you know, the major museums and spaces, non-profit spaces were doing around the world, but also looking at what the very interesting things that commercial spaces were doing. And also it was very important to have a range of voices in terms of who was commentating, of who was exploring these ideas. So, you know, I was always very interested in new voices writing about art, you know, younger voices or voices from communities that perhaps we hadn't seen in the magazine, to also recognizing the brilliance of older, more established art historians and curators. So I always liked the idea of a kaleidoscope of a magazine, that you've got all these different refractions.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And you've got a great rhythm in the magazine between, a bit like a piece of music, you know, that you have,
yeah,
you have your andante and then you have your allegro, you know, that you have, so it doesn't become monotone or monochrome.
You must have an enormous community. You were talking about community of and a network of people who were bringing you lots of information, are bringing you information of what's new, what's going on, what's contemporary, what's hot. Can you talk a little bit about how you make sense of all of this infinite world of data so that you could synthesize it down into the curation of the magazine?
Well, you know, I do think that this is a mix of systems and intuition. A bit like, you know, when you go into a party, you sort of know where you make a beeline for someone, but you might get waylaid on the way by someone interesting who you realize you've got to stop and talk to. As I mentioned before, you know, we would have a framework for the magazine of, you know, the various slots that you want to fill in the magazine, new voices, old voices, recognizing your achievement and honoring people who have been working for decades in the field. But in terms of a network, it's a mix of, I mean, I personally would go to as many shows as I could. And, you know, often I would be blown away by something that I hadn't expected that I would be blown away by. And so then you quickly make room in the next issue or online to recognize that. It's a matter of talking to lots and lots of people, to having a brilliant editorial staff. Like at Frieze, we always had lots and lots of discussions, lots of arguments, editorial meetings every week. You know, every week people would be encouraged to, you know, say, I saw this amazing show in a tiny nonprofit in Peckham, or I went to the National Gallery and saw Titian and it was the most amazing show I'd ever seen. So, you know, it's about conversation and distilling that conversation into something that you feel might be of interest to other people as well. You know, because to put a magazine together is, in a sense, it's about it's an act of seduction. We're bombarded with information. Why should someone stop and read this magazine at this point in time?
Well, it's amazing for me because, you know, we put books together. I think Paul and my cycle is about, it takes 2 years to get a book from start to finish, and that's working at pace. And the idea of doing a magazine on a monthly basis is quite something, because you're essentially creating a book every time.
Yeah, I mean, Frieze is 8 issues a year. And then I also edit Frieze Masters, which comes out once a year. And that's a more art historical magazine. And of course, we've got online content. It was like having about 100 conversations in your head at once. And especially as I'm a writer as well. So it was I trained as a waitress. And I think that was very useful. A lot of the things that I learned as a waitress I carry with me now. For example, you know, the golden rule of waitressing, which is never waste a journey. You know, so if you go out to get someone's order, if you're going back to the kitchen, you take the plates with you. You know, never waste a journey, I think, is a very good rule just for life.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, that you always find something wherever you go. And also, when you're a waitress in a busy restaurant, if you're looking after 10 tables and each of those tables have 4, 6, or 2 people, you've got an enormous amount to process and to remember. So to be a good waitress, and I must say, I'm going to say very boastfully, I was a good waitress. You know, you have to be extremely organized in your thinking.
I was a terrible waiter, I can tell you.
Were you?
I love editing books. I love creating books. And I love that whole process. I mean, there's something really powerful about doing all the research and then having this mass of ideas which are all unordered and unstructured, and then finding the story through it and also finding the order that emerges. I mean, we have a nice story about when we developed our 7 C's model of curiosity. It completely emerged from the conversations we have. We don't take it too seriously, but the reason we got to 7 C's and the idea of sailing the 7 C's of curiosity was simply because we had all of this information which started to order itself, and we found that there were about 5 categories which we labeled, all of which began with the letter C. And then we thought, well, can we extend that? And the game was, how do we make it, you know, so we got to 7 C's, and then we said 7 C's, well, sailing the 7 C's. I mean, it was that simple.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag Curious Advantage and join the conversation.
One of the C's we talk about, as Garrett says, is curation. And when we talk about curation, there are some great concepts such as the derive and psychogeography that contemporary artists use that are great for being curious. Do you have other concepts or ideas that artists use that come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many different kinds of artists, obviously, that it's hard to generalize. Thinking generally about the artists that I know and the art that I'm interested in, I think that it tends to stem from a place of unknowing often. I think the best artists often, even though they might have, you know, a very general idea of what they're looking for and what medium they're using, or, you know, what ideas they might be exploring, they're not too fixed about what the end result will be. And so the making of the work itself reveals things to the artist and to the medium, maybe. Process itself of making art is a kind of exploration. So that's why the best art is often, it can be loosely categorized as surrealism or, you know, cubism or neo-expressionism, but often it's sort of uncomfortable with the boundaries that are containing it. So it's slightly pushing against them or dissolving them or slightly reinterpreting them. So most artists I know don't particularly like these kind of definitions. You know, they might have a general interest, like they might be exploring identity politics. But the result of that exploration shouldn't be too pigeonholed.
And one thing I find fascinating about what you just said there about unknowing is that in a business context, often this is the opposite of what's expected. If you arrive at a meeting and people say, well, what's your ideas? Where's your starting point? I'm going to come with the idea of I know nothing. It's not usually the way people like to present and come across in these meetings. Do artists have to work at that to keep in that state or mindset of unknowing when they're approaching a new project or continuing an existing piece of work?
You know, I really think that they do. I think it's hard because, and this is one of my bugbears, is that, and I don't now mean to alienate every funding body under the sun, but funding bodies demand of artists that they behave like accountants, yeah. You know? And every artist I know is driven mad by funding bodies' applications. And I totally understand that funding bodies need some sort of, you know, way of justifying the money that they're going to give to them. But at the same time, when artists are asked for what the outcome of the work will be, or who will see it, who will engage with it, how will it engage with the broader community, often you don't know that before you started. You might have a vague idea. And so most of them sort of have to slightly, you know, fudge these applications. It drives them mad. And then when they start making the work, they feel the sort of bureaucratic anxiety of fulfilling the remit so that the grant isn't taken off them.
This idea of the unknowing and then also the starting point being the unknown and remaining open, because, I mean, I think that the great role of art and contemporary art is not only to entertain us, but more than that, great art should really question us and call us to count and make us consider the world in different ways. And that's always outside of the frame and always outside of our comfort zone, because it's taking me to places I haven't considered before. That's why I love art, and I get so much out of the art world. And the other thing, I think, I mean, we talk about this in our book, you know, there you can be curious about known things or known contexts. Like, I want to play jazz, and I talk about this a lot, and I work with a community of people who are jazz, and the language of jazz is very figured, if you like. It's configured, but yet art, when you know you need a language, but like the language of jazz, but to be an artist and even a jazz artist, you actually take that somewhere else. You are free to go somewhere else, and you create new context as a result. I mean, which is why I really, you know, relate to what you're talking about, the making of the piece of art, whether it's art or music, or the making of something. It creates new context entirely on its own, and it's a different way of exploring the world and different way of achieving something which is new in the world, as opposed to exploring something which is already known.
I absolutely agree with you, and you know, I think that this might be a good moment to talk about the importance of messy thinking. Messiness often results in something new, where if you're being too tight about your own creativity or about, you know, what you think you should be exploring, then you're just going to reiterate what's come before. And actually, harking back to these amazing women, so many amazing women in art history, you know, they were messy thinkers in a sense, because they were thinking outside of what was expected of their own gender. You know, so, and that's why they expanded their own horizons. You know, I think sometimes a tidy house isn't a particularly healthy house.
I love the idea of messy thinking. Jennifer, it's been so much fun to speak with you. I think if we have time for one more question, if you wanted our listeners to take one thing away from today's podcast, and particularly if they're thinking about how they could be successfully curious, no matter what their context, what would that be?
To my mind, remaining curious means being restless in your thinking. You know, you ask what you might learn, not what you know. So if you go to a gallery, say, and you think, rather than head straight for, say, the Impressionists, which I've loved for the last 20 years, why don't I wander around the 16th century, you know, Dutch still life section, which I've never really thought about, and wonder, what does a knife signify in 1620? When it's balanced rather precariously on the edge of a table.
Thank you, Jennifer. That's been amazing. Such a brilliant conversation, wide-ranging, talking about editing and curation and frameworks and messy thinking and women in art history and unconscious bias and conscious bias, critical thinking and so on. Brilliant. And how do you edit a magazine rapidly? It's just so brilliant. Thank you, Jennifer. Fascinating as always.
Thank you so much, Garrick and Paul. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Subscribe to the podcast today. Follow #CuriousAdvantage and join the conversation. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.